Hey, welcome along. Bienvenue to Le Monde. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 5 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. Newfoundland and Labrador, 9 p.m. in London and Dublin, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in Jerusalem and Istanbul, and the early hours of the morning for our Asian and Pacific listeners. But wherever you are in this turbulent world, we're glad you're along for the ride for another edition of our Clubland Q&A. Anyone can listen. Any 7 billion people around the planet are free to listen, and we hope at least 3 or 4 billion of them are. If they can say that at the Oscars, you know, they always say, 1 billion people are watching around the world, and it's actually, I think on the last Oscar show, it was about 200,000. We can do that too. Welcome along. It is great to have you with us. Here's how it works. As I said, anyone can listen. But you have to be a Mark Stein Club member to ask a question. And we always have good questions, and I'm looking forward to them this time. I wanted to pick up on something Tal Backman. Tal is a terrific guest columnist here at Stein Online. And he mentioned that Ben Shapiro line the other day. I think he was just actually responding to a commenter about exposing the truth. You know, that all conservatives have to do is just keep exposing the truth. He said that presupposes, Tal said that presupposes human beings are rational beings. And that Ben Shapiro-like recitations of facts will win over hearts and minds more than great stories, visions, causes, crusades, dramas, challenges, etc. And Tal is quite right. I brought this up, I can't remember now whether I was hosting for Tucker or on the 7 o'clock show on Fox, but I was talking to Raymond Arroyo. And he agreed with me on this. Like Ben Shapiro's great line... whatever it is, I've forgotten what it is now. His line, my facts, your feelings don't trump my facts, or whatever. My facts aren't negated by your whatever his line is about the facts and the feelings. And Raymond Arroyo and I agreed that in fact it's the other way around. That obviously in our world, feelings do trump facts, in part because people want their lives to be a romance. They don't want it to be like a balance sheet that your accountant does, hands to you in time for April the 15th or whatever. They don't have a green eyeshade approach to that. So that whatever his line is, your feelings don't trump my facts. In fact, his facts don't trump your feelings. And that's what we're living with around various aspects of political life throughout the Western world. So anyway, I thought Tal's comment was very well put, and we should... I should throw it in here. Michael from Colorado writes, hi, Mark. I always look forward to your Q&As. One of the club's very best offerings. By the way, I'm thoroughly enjoying The Green Fraud. That's the new book by Mark Morano. I've done the foreword to it. That's just a couple of pages, but the rest of the book is worth reading too. So don't throw it away after the foreword. The Green Fraud, it's Mark Morano's new book. You can get it wherever good books are sold. Which boils down to, I think, the Stein Online bookstore. I don't know what you can get at Amazon these days. Michael says, you often talk about the importance of words and how the Liberals have been masters at using words language to cover up and sugarcoat their real intentions. Well, we club members are a unique group. We actually believe our lying eyes. So it's time to drop any reference to the Democratic Party, Democrats, Liberals, Progressives. They are now the Socialist Party inhabited by socialists. All who have their eyes and ears open should start telling it like it is from this day forward. Thanks again for all you do. Michael, you're sounding like a Georgia Senate candidate in early January, and a Republican Senate candidate in Georgia in early January. They kept going about radical socialist agenda, as if you just keep saying radical socialist agenda and it's enough to scare the bejesus out of people and they'll all come stampeding back to your fold. I don't think social, if you look at the polls, in fact, particularly for young persons, which these days one defines as anybody under 87, socialism isn't a scary word. They're well, you know, they're not ill-disposed toward it. And likewise, and I assume they got this from Karl Rove or some other genius of the Republican Party, when those Republican Senate candidates in Georgia were going on about radical socialist agenda. You know, we live in a world where, and I'm not just talking about, you know, Nancy Boy Europeans or anything. I'm talking about residents of New York and California and New Jersey and Pennsylvania and all kinds of other places, except that the government can tell you whether you can have Auntie Mabel round for Thanksgiving, which is way beyond anything socialists did in some ways. In communist Eastern Europe, the social patterns of life, like seeing your Auntie Mabel or whatever the Hungarian version of Auntie Mabel is, went on under communism. So I don't think socialism, this is new. You know, Marx and Engels were wrong, and people who followed them slaughtered millions in trying to prove them right. But Marx and Engels were serious people when they were writing the Communist Manifesto. What we have now is a cultural Marxism, which is Marx exponentially more destructive. It's not an economic theory. It's a theory about every aspect of humanity, including whether a boy is a boy and a girl is a girl. And I don't think socialism, you know, I don't know what we call it. And I agree with people who say, well, you know, when you keep going on about wokesters and wokeism, you make it sound like it's all a bit of a joke. We should have some more serious name for it. But I don't think socialism sounds very 20th century to me. And we're actually witnessing something far more ambitious, which is the abolition, the complete abolition on a scale that to a certain extent was beyond the Marxist-Leninist imagination, or at any rate beyond the possibility of doing it. They were certainly opposed to family, and they were certainly happy to have the state take the place of family, but certain things, like, as I said, abolishing biology. You know, we're up against something. You know, I was looking up somebody just on the internet or whatever, and I'm reading. Was it Demi Lovato? Because I saw that if you don't know Demi Lovato, good on you. Because my daughter had the misfortune to see her in concert and she was bloody awful. But anyway, she's just decided she's non-binary and that her pronouns are they and there. And some Massachusetts disc jockey walked off the job because he was instructed he couldn't make jokes about Demi Lovato. It's all very serious. You know, encyclopedias, hospitals, they now talk about, you know, was assigned the female gender at birth. Demi Lovato was assigned the female gender at birth, but she's now non-binary. So we have to, I can't even say she. I'd be fired if I was at that crapo Massachusetts, you know, all hit 95.7 or whatever it is, because I've just called her she, and we're now supposed to call her they. You know, and that's way beyond, I don't know what that is, but it's way beyond socialism. It's a level of cultural insanity that's way beyond that. And don't forget, we have a vice president, you know, and the right, as always, is late to the party. Because the right's thing is always to say, oh, this is just a peripheral thing. It's just like a fringe thing. I remember this when I used to point out these stories. Portents of tomorrow. That's what I always like. Portents of tomorrow. And I, when this thing started, and I'd point them out, and people would say, why are you talking about that? Why aren't you talking about Mitt being 2 points up in Iowa? Because Mitt being 2 points up in Iowa doesn't mean anything. It's not important. But the fact that they're abolishing biology is, and that's way beyond socialism. Scott Scherzer said, dear Mark, lately I've been hearing from serious people that there is significant evidence that UFOs have been observed in US airspace. Really? I thought Joe Biden had cancelled them because of the COVID. I thought, oh, is that the European Union? I don't know. But I wouldn't have thought with the COVID. Have they got the vaccine passport, these aliens? Anyway, if in fact we are being visited by a civilization from beyond our solar system, Scott is writing this from Miami Beach. So he may have seen aliens in Miami Beach. I don't think they've come to northern New Hampshire. It's too cold for them. If we are in fact being visited by a civilization from beyond our solar system, do you think they pose a greater danger to us than China? Wherever they might come from, I think I would rather be ruled by them than the Democrat Party. You've got to be careful, Scott, because the Democrats, they think ahead, so they might already be in alliance with the space aliens. Do you know, what would you do if you were an intelligent form of life and you landed on this planet and you thought you'd grasp the essentials, and then you land and the first thing in the news is Demi Lovato announcing that she's non-binary and she has to be called they and there. There's nothing in your Foda's guide on, you know, to Earth on a dollar a day or whatever these space aliens are using that's in there that would have any account. You'd be on the first rocket out of there. Eric Dale writes, hey, Mark, the lockdowns are coming to an end here in the red states and hopefully they won't be coming back. However, and as you pointed out, the left and more than a few establishment type Republicans seem to want to keep us in a permanent state of emergency, the January the 6th Commission being a recent prominent example. How can we resist the next it's different this time? Well, I think most of America is post-COVID now. And actually, in fairness, so is much of the Western world, with the terrible exception of Canada. But you're right. I think there's an urge at a very high level. I noticed, what was it? I think it was Sky News, the UK version of Sky News, not the Oz one. But I noticed that everyone's vaccinated and all the rest of it. But they're almost wishing, they've got this Indian variant, and they're wishing that the vaccines are ineffective in the face of the Indian variant, so they never need come out of lockdown. There's on the media side, the big media side, there's a lot of enthusiasm for that. But in America, what's going on is different. The characterization of January the 6th, and, you know, we all know the commission will be a racket, and commissions is something America doesn't do well. The 9/11 commission was complete rubbish. And, you know, the reality is that there should have been huge resignations because all the big money, no object alphabet soup flopped on 9/11. Whatever it was, the FAA or whatever it's called, somebody at air traffic control called them to see what they should do about the whatever it was, the second or third plane being hijacked. And they just, the person at the other end at the FAA said, I can't tell you anything. Everybody's left the room. They all just sort of failed. They froze and failed. And the 9/11 Commission is a pointless thing. You know, oh, let's have a... Now, here what's interesting is the urgency with which they've set up the Commission. So unlike the 9/11 thing, which was a, you know, a real national trauma, and in a sense a humiliating failure of the systems, but what we have here is something on an entirely different scale, which is that all the big agencies, the big deep state surveillance state agencies, have signed on to the administration's line that the biggest threat to America is white supremacy. And they're running with that. And the point about it is to make you ashamed of having voted for Trump, because there's whatever it is, 75 million Trump voters out there, and they want to make sure that those 75 million people actually feel just like four people, and so they don't want to know about you know, the fact that what's evil about this is it's basically the criminalization of political opposition. So we're actually seeing one party state stuff going on here. It's been that way for 5 years, basically, one party state, where Trump was in office, but it turned out, and he's supposedly the head of the executive branch, but it turns out that a significant proportion, maybe actually even a majority of the executive branch, is in fact working for the party that lost the 2016 election. That's clear with particularly with the deep state surveillance agencies. And so what they've done is, with what happened on January the 6th, where I forget who it was who said this, but they made a very good point that a lot of Trump supporters who showed up were people of guys in a certain age, not in the best shape, getting up there in years, and five people died. And four of them just keeled over from heart attacks. One guy, I think, was high on something. And the only actual attack that day, assault that day, fatal homicidal assault, was the guy who put the bullet in Ashley Babbitt, right? The guy who put the bullet in Ashley Babbitt. Everybody else was just wandering around goofily. They're now, as I've been talking, and I can't believe that nobody else on the right is embarrassed by this, as in a sense they should be. It's a bunch of goofballs wandering around in Viking horns and everything. But these guys are looking at 7 years in the one guy, the guy for putting one foot on Nancy Pelosi's desk, is looking at 7 years in the slammer. That's the deal they've offered him. Go to jail for 7 years for trespassing, for putting your foot on Nancy Pelosi's desk. Or we're going to throw the book at you, and you'll be like whatever the name of that guy in Charlottesville, the guy with mental health issues or whatever, who ran over that woman. He's in jail for something like 473 years. So with time off for good behavior, if he's lucky, he'll be out in 312 years. This is an evil system, particularly at the federal level. And what they're going to do, now the point of this commission will to actually be to create out of thin air a right-wing domestic terrorism thing that will, in effect, the post 9/11 security apparatus that hasn't actually been terribly useful at dealing with overseas enemies will nevertheless now be applied domestically. It's a serious thing. And we should actually resist it. Let us see. Oh, Timothy McDonald says, how do you think the public relation war is going for the Israelis and Hamas? I'm always interested. Basically, Israel is on a high. Well, I'll back up a bit. First, this is going on, I think, in part because of we're in the post-Trump era. If you notice, when Trump was in the White House, people didn't pull this stuff. The Middle East just went very quiet. And in the first few months, he was busy rolling up ISIS. So, in fact, on the ground, in the bazaars, ISIS and co. were the big losers. It was humiliating. Now, this is going on, and it's back to suddenly, oh, Israel is being disproportionate. Disproportionate. Which is not a useful concept, really, in any kind of warfare. Because you're basically you're trying to second guess the people who are responsible. They know what's, for example, that AP building. The AP guys there are propagandists. They're not reporters, and there's all kinds of Hamas stuff going on in there anyway. But the thing is, Israel can't get a good. Israel basically factors in that the world's media are going to be against it. If you listen to the BBC, for example, they're always going on about how many children Israel's killed, and then at the end there'll be a sentence about how there've been rockets fired into Israel by Hamas militants. Jeremy Corbyn is a militant because he doesn't actually fire rockets into Israel. He's just well disposed toward those who do fire rockets into Israel. But when you're actually part of the government of Gaza, which Hamas is, and you're actually the guys firing rockets into Israel, I don't think militants. I don't think militants quite do it. But I liked, you know, I miss already. I think that was one of Trump's great achievements, was that he just made the Middle East go away. He was regard. You know, when Biden came in, he was doing this. Oh, America's back thing. America's back. No. America was back when Trump was there. And as I said, just made it, you know, he took out ISIS and then the Middle East just, and all the Middle East just went away. They do these things. It's like after 9/11. When whoever it was called up Pakistan, called up General Musharraf and said, if we don't get what we want, we're going to flatten Pakistan. And for a moment, you know, General Musharraf thought, oh, I don't know what's happened. The Americans are serious. And that's what people understood, I think, when Trump was there. Dale Owens, who is a Welshman, living near Milan. maybe there are many people from Milan living near Swansea or Llandudno. I don't know. Maybe it's a reciprocal arrangement. Dale Owens writes, Dear Mark, I've often heard Justin Trudeau commenting that Canada is a nation of immigrants or is a nation built on immigration. Recently, George W. Bush said something on the same lines about the US. Surely this is manipulation of language for ideological reasons. An immigrant is a person who moves to a state that is already in existence. These countries were actually built by pioneers and settlers. What do you think? I don't know whether I'd go along with that. Basically, I mean, when Justin Trudeau talks about that, he's talking rubbish. Canada, the Dominion of Canada, and the provinces of British North America before that, that's not immigration. What that means is that somebody from Kingston, Ontario moves to Kingston, Ontario or Kingston, Jamaica. That's internal movement within what was then His Majesty's or Her Majesty's dominions. That's also true of the early American colonies. And as I always point out, there was a survey done in 1992 that showed that half the people in America were descendants of the people who'd been there by 1776. So if they pulled up the drawbridge on July the 4th, 1776, in 1992... there'd still be half the population of America in 1992 because they're all descendants of that. Now that's so this whole construction of a nation of immigrants thing has never been true. In Canada for most of its early years, it was internal settlement within the British Empire. In America, once they'd checked out of the British Empire, they put in place different policies. We talked about it on the last edition of the Mark Steyn Show, the 1921 Immigration Act, because they thought Northern and Western Europeans were more assimilable than Southern and Eastern Europeans. The whole nation of immigrants thing is just a horror. I find it an absolutely horrible line. I don't know why anybody would want to be a nation of immigrants, but it's because it implies something unhealthy about you, as of America and Canada and Europe right at the moment, where nobody has sufficient faith in the future to want to bring any new Canadians or Americans or Europeans into the world. So you have to import all these people to be the children you couldn't be buggered to have yourself. And so you have to invent a myth that puts a sentimentalist gloss on it and which is impossible to... Oh, nation of immigrants. I did this. I don't want to seem cranky, Dale, but I did this at that debate, the monk debate in Toronto, whatever it was, a couple of years back, against Simon Sharma. I said, watch my concluding statement, where I said, the French gave America a pretty great Statue of Liberty, and the Americans nailed a crappy poem onto the bottom of it and turned it into a statue of immigration. And they completely perverted the meaning of that statue. It's a statue of liberty. Liberty is standing there with her torch out to the world. But because they stuck the stupid poem saying, send us all your teeming refuse or whatever it is, everyone thinks now that that statue is some kind of great big immigration thing and that it's profoundly un-American. No society needs mass immigration now, particularly mass unskilled immigration. It's just idiotic. And the idea that, I don't know what to... We've always been a nation of... In the mid-19th century. So what about the mid-19th century? They didn't have any... Do you want to live in the mid-19th century? They used to have men and women then. That's it. Demi Lovato wouldn't have got a look in the America of 1873. Aside from being a nation of immigrants, it was a nation of farmers and a nation of buggy whip manufacturers. What's with this? Oh, well, you know, we had immigration in the mid-19th century, so we've got to have it now and forever. You don't have anything. You don't have men. You don't have women. You've abolished everything. You don't have any statues from the mid-19th century. Maybe if you scour a really big city, you can still find a 19th century. Everything else from the 19th century is crap to the left. The idea that the one thing from the 19th century, that's inviolable, nation of immigrants, blah, 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 blah. So it's rubbish. It's a lie. It's a lie. And societies never prosper when they lie to themselves. Elizabeth Hodgson writes from my hometown. Hi, Mark. Greetings from Toronto, which is toe-rotten at the moment, along with the rest of the province of Ontario. But on to sunnier topics. Question. Read the Mark Steyn Cruise. Will passengers be required to provide proof of vaccine? I can't emphasize enough that I'm not anti-vax. I'm just anti-this vax. Not because I think it's unsafe. though I believe it has its problems, or that it will microchip me for future identification purposes when the new China-style social credit program expands to the West. I think it actually has already expanded, Elizabeth. I simply have a policy of refusing medications I don't need, nor am I thrilled about the incessant pressure to submit to it. Something about the peer pressure automatically puts my back up. So will the refuseniks be refused from setting sail? Absolutely love your show, and I'm grateful to you for keeping me sane all these pandemic months. All the best, Liz. Well, will passengers be required to provide proof of vaccine? I don't know, because things change week by week on this front. I notice, though, that the European Union, which Americans and Canadians are forbidden to set foot in right now, to get into the European Union nation, if you're not the citizen of another European nation, is very. I think there's. The UK, Australia, New Zealand, and I think a couple of countries in French Africa for some strange reason. But Americans and Canadians can't set foot in the European Union now. And there's very, very, very limited exceptions to that. And I actually thought I had someone who might qualify for an exemption, but there's no like family or health exemptions there. It's very strict, you know, Americans, Canadians banned. And they've now said that they're going to allow Americans and Canadians back in if they're vaccinated. I believe this changes in the next week or two. And I don't know whether that will become permanent, but I've said really since the beginning of this thing, the permanent emergency, that I think actually the end of mass international travel, which is also the goal of the climate change crowd, may well be a consequence of this. So the fact of the matter is that, as I said, when they changed the rules on June the 9th, if you want to get into the European Union and you've got a US passport or a Canadian passport, you're going to have proof of vaccination to be admitted. Right now, they have, if you go from country to country, I did this a while back and I was in like, you know, trying to get to four countries, which meant I had, in a very short space of time, which meant I had four COVID tests in the space of a week. Now they're moving on beyond that to this proof of vaccination, and if that is what they come up with, I don't know what will it's going to be like by the time the Mark Steyn cruise sails, but it is a cruise that is within the European Union, with the exception of the British colony of Gibraltar, where everybody's been vaccinated. So I don't know the politics of this, Elizabeth. And you're right, you might not need to have this vaccine for yourself. The point about the vaccines, I think, is also means that you can't pick the thing up and then infect your granny or whatever. But the politics of this is weird to me because it's Trump. Trump got these vaccines. It's basically the Trump juice. And Trump himself has said, get the vaccine, get the vaccine. It's my vaccine. If you remember back a couple of months before the election, the Democrats were the ones who didn't want to get the Trump juice. You know, Kamala Harris said she didn't want to take something that Trump had just been mixing up in the Oval Office. She wasn't going to stick that in her arm nowhere. And then it turned on a dime in the way these things do in America, where everything becomes super partisan. And even though it's the Trump juice, it's Trump supporters who don't want to. Who don't want to take it. I never know how the politics of this becomes like that. But I read what, you know, basically the European Union isn't going to let any American or Canadian, starting in June, they'll open, an American or Canadian will be allowed to fly to Europe, but only if they've had the Trump juice. And I would be surprised if that were to change in the next few months. You don't know. We don't know, but that's the way it's looking. Richard Malaby writes, "Hey, Mark, as always, love the club. Personal questions today. What's your favorite literary genre? Do you stick to politics, history, culture, classics, great books, fiction, mysteries, or something out of left field? Who would you say your top two or three favorite authors, and what makes them your favorites?" Well, since we've just been talking about long-haul flights and long-haul travel, and the Mark sign, when I'm flying, you said mysteries. I always like a thriller to read on the plane for that boring bit. If it's the red eye, then when you get on the plane, the boring bit is when they've closed the door and it then takes ages to take off. And I always like, so that's when, and they also, I think when the door closes, that's when you can't have all your laptops and all that kind of stuff. So I always like to have a thriller to read on a, just for that period. And then if it's like a long haul flight, you know, so you read it and then the plane takes off and they bring you your meal on the crappy plastic tray or whatever it is. It's all gotten worse now because they basically use the COVID as a way of, you know, even further diminishing the lousy cabin service. And so I like to have like a paperback book for that kind of rather boring bit of the process. Just a thriller, just to have something to read until they've given me the food and the plastic tray and they take the plastic tray away and then I go to sleep. So that's what I like. That's my plane reading. And in fact, the last flight, I read an old book, an old thriller by, not that thrilling a thriller, not that mysterious a mystery, by Elspeth Huxley, set in colonial East Africa and with a Canadian detective. You can find mysteries set in East Africa and you can find Canadian detectives, but you can't find many with a Canadian detective in colonial East Africa. I think it was called Murder at Government House. And why am I talking about Elspeth Huxley? I haven't thought about Elspeth Huxley in years until I read this book. Johnny B writes, "Hi, Mark, I like your comments about Northern Ireland and find your knowledge on such a small place quite remarkable. You'll no doubt have heard that Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary found that the police service of Northern Ireland acted properly in allowing an IRA funeral with several thousand attendees to proceed unhindered. The inspectorate adjudicated that due to the complex nature of the COVID regulations, there was not enough evidence that any of the attendees had knowingly committed an offence. Don't you think the entire inquiry could have been avoided by just quoting Kathy Shadle, as you did yesterday, that it's different when we do it?" On a more pleasant topic, your frequent assertion that if everyone is racist Hitler, then nobody is racist Hitler. It always reminds me, I usually say if everyone's racist, nobody's racist. If everyone's Hitler, nobody's Hitler. That always reminds me, says Johnny B, of the Gilbert and Sullivan song from the Gondoliers, "There Lived a King," which concludes with the lines, "In short, whoever you may be, with this conclusion you'll agree, when everybody is somebody, then no one's anybody." In all your musical discussions over the years, I've never heard you mention Gilbert and Sullivan. Are you a fan? I don't know. I have mentioned Gilbert and Sullivan over the years, in part because they were the idols of all the people I write about more frequently, like Rodgers and Hart and the Gershwins and Yip Harburg. And all those guys loved Gilbert and Sullivan. And in fact, the great Australian conductor, Sir Charles Mackerras, a few years ago, he did all the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas for the BBC. And I did the big cover story for Radio Times, which is the BBC's thing that lists all the telly and radio shows. And because back in those days, the Beeb understood that I was like I'm not one of these total GNS experts, but they knew I was a fan and I could put GNS in the context of, in the broader context. And so they got me to do the big cover story to launch Sir Charles Mackerras conducting every single one of the Savoy operas. So I strongly resent you saying I have never mentioned Gilbert and Sullivan. I've got some form there. David P. writes, "Hi, Mark. I heard you plugging Rake again recently." We're getting some rather odd questions here. Rake is that Australian TV series that is very about a dissolute barrister in Sydney. And I started watching it at the time I was being sued by all these wankers like Carrie Katz and Michael Mann. Because if you've had like a hard day being deposed by some third-rate twit of a lawyer like Eric M. George, this ludicrous lawyer that Carrie Katz and Dennis Prager also keeps making the mistake of hiring. But anyway, if you've ever been deposed by that guy, you want to come home and relax after the deposition. And so I'd watch Australian legal dramas, and Rake with Richard Roxburgh is the best. And David says, "Have you seen Blue Murder, also starring Richard Roxburgh? I reckon it is the best TV ever produced in Oz. Interested to hear your thoughts if you've watched it." I haven't seen that one, although I know a little bit about the background of the real life background to it. The last thing I saw Richard Roxburgh in, he was playing Bob Hawke, the Australian Prime Minister, in an episode of The Crown. And I thought, ooh, Richard Roxburgh is Bob Hawke. That should be worth watching. And actually, I didn't feel he quite filled the shoes of Bob Hawke in that episode of The Crown. But I'll leave it at that. Nancy K writes, "I agree that James Golden's podcast series is great and your contribution was marvellous. Thank you for appearing." Well, I was honoured to do that. If you haven't yet heard this is James Golden. He's Mr. Snerdly. Known to tens of millions of Americans as Mr. Snerdly on the Rush Limbaugh Show, which he did for decades. And I've worked with him for whatever it is, 15 years now. When he first called me up to ask me to guest host, I did that thing. I was a bit where he said, "Mark, this is Bo Snerdly." And I went, "Oh, yes." I was a bit wary because I knew Bo Snerdly was not a person who had corporeal existence. And I was a bit, so I was a bit wary when a guy claimed, I thought, like Conrad Black did when Donald Trump called him up to say he'd pardoned him. And for the first 2 minutes of the call, Conrad was wary because he thought it was a prank from some of the reptiles in Fleet Street. Or, you know, some morning zoo guys on a Quebec radio station. The people do this kind of thing. And I thought it was a prank when Mr. Snerdly called up. But it is a great podcast that gives you a great insight into Rush away from the microphone, what it required to make that show the number one show. And it's, so if you haven't yet heard it, I'm there for, you know, whatever it is, 2 minutes. But the rest of the stuff is an absolute corker. It's very well done. James does this series. It's a really good series. And James Golden, Mr. Snerdly, he'll be joining us on the Mark Steyn Cruise, as will the aforementioned Conrad Black. Jamie says, Mark, I heard you speak about the closure of the Canada-US border on your show this week. As an imprisoned Canadian, I share your concerns. But I note conservative politicians like Erin O'Toole and Doug Ford have been the loudest voices trying to keep it closed for even longer and make it even harder for people who are entitled to enter the country to do so. Why do you think this is? Well, I think Canadian conservatism... I don't think, and I separate the politicians from this, but I don't think ordinary Canadians, rank and file Canadians, understand what an outlier they are compared to almost anywhere else in the Western world. And it's weird to me, of course, because they watch a lot of American TV, and in certain networks like CTV are just carry all the crappy American sitcoms and dramas, but they also see a lot of American news, so they must understand, and they also spend half the year in Florida, so they must understand. The way I put it is, it's incredible, you know, Canadian snowbirds flying back from Florida only to find that in Toronto, it's still, and in Montreal, that it's still March 2020. And there's no... that's just the American comparison. But again, if you compare it to other places that Canadians are familiar with, like the United Kingdom, where people are drinking in pubs again. This extreme lockdown, no vaccines, no herd immunity. Canada, now Justin saying graciously that you'll be, even though the borders close, you'll be allowed to go to America as long as you just get a vaccine while you're down there, and then come straight back. I'm astonished, because Canada's one of these, you know, most people don't think about all these stupid polls. You know, there'll be international polls, The Economist, the best country in the world to live in, the best education system in the world, the best health system in the world, the best quality of life in the world, the best housing market in the world, and Canadian news dwells on this crap incessantly. It's like half the stories on the National. You know, oh, there's new survey shows that Canada is the number one most desirable place in the world to live. We've just had here a catastrophic failure on every level. And the fact is that it's a bipartisan failure, because the so-called conservative parties have flopped out here too. And I have no use for Erin O'Toole. You know, Rush said this shortly before he died. He was talking about some senator. And he said what he, a guy he'd always, I think from, I forget who he, which senator it was. But what he objected to was, and in fact it could be a whole bunch of them. What he objected to was the guy talking like a liberal, like a Democrat. He was framing the issue, it was climate change, and he was talking like a liberal. He was using the same lingo. And of course, if you use the same lingo, you basically are accepting all the premises of the Democrats or the liberals. And this is where I've got no use for Erin O'Toole. And it's... You know, right now you would have to bet that Justin Trudeau is going to be re-elected, incredibly, because he's failed, but the leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition has been so loyal he's forgotten the bit about the opposition. He's so loyal to Justin that he's basically said hallelujah, amen, for this disastrous. So we have I know we make jokes in Washington about the Uniparty. It's not that in Ottawa. What it is we have a failed Liberal Prime Minister and a so-called leader of the loyal opposition who actually doesn't oppose anything. I use that phrase. I'm not, you know, when I say leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition, I think we had a bit on this in The Prisoner of Windsor last summer. Yes, we did, I think, because it came up in a chapter that had Prime Minister's questions in it. And it's actually a useful phrase in the hideous world we live in now, where there are correct views that one is not permitted to oppose. Like this poor disc jockey in Massachusetts who's out of work because he wanted to make a joke about Demi Lovato. The title, because it gets to the heart of what free society is about, the title, Leader of Her Majesty's Loyal Opposition, assumes that opposition is part of what it means to be a free society. It doesn't mean you're disloyal to oppose. And this goes back to the January 6th thing, where after January 6th, I mean, I couldn't stand it. And that's why I went on Tucker and I said, you know, this is all rubbish. And that's why I said the following day, and all the newspapers picked up on it, you know, Citadel of crap. But this idea that within days, George Stephanopoulos and people are demanding of Rand Paul that he has to sign on to the official version of events. No, the reason why you have as a formal title leader of the opposition is because opposition is not just a right, but a defining characteristic of free societies. And what we have is right now is insufficient opposition, ineffective opposition. And as I said, in the particular case of Erin O'Toole, the loyal opposition has been so loyal it hasn't done any bloody opposing. AJ writes, "Hi, Mark. Are you following the Arizona recount? Does it even matter anymore? I see that the deleted records have been recovered. Is this something that we can fix for next time, or do you think it's too late?" You know, there's a little bit of this going on in Windham, New Hampshire, which is the other end of New Hampshire for me. I'm in the northwest, and Windham is down in the southwest, not a part of New Hampshire I go to terribly often. Very different kind of a vibe down there. But Windham has historically been a Republican town and always returned Republican candidates. And we're told it's moving a bit more centrist, this Republican town. Well, anyway, on November the 3rd, the Democrat candidate, all the state reps, full slate, four. I think they elect four state reps. It's quite a big town by New Hampshire size. I think it's about 15,000 people. And they elected all Republican state reps. And the Democrat candidate complained and asked for a recount. And when they had the manual recount, they found that, in fact, the machine had undercounted Republican votes by about 200. So the Democrat complained, and all that happened was it turned out she'd lost by a wider margin. But what was interesting to me about that is that Joe Biden supposedly got the highest number of votes that any Democrat presidential candidate has ever gotten in that town. I don't know whether ever, but, you know, for half a century or whatever, more. A spectacular vote for Joe Biden. And so it was fascinating to me that when they recount the state rep things there, they find that the machines were under, and they use machines in this town, which they don't in my town, that the machines had undercounted the Republican vote. It is all, and this is in one of, I think, the least corrupt states. But it is a rotten system, and I can't emphasize this. During that whole period between November the 3rd and January the 20th, I said this on Rush, I thought I was in a blizzard of insanity, and it was one South African caller and one Canadian caller, immigrants to America. And they, like me, are utterly bewildered at this farce of a system. It exists for a reason. It exists for a reason. It exists to enable corrupt political machines, which is a thing in America. It's not really a thing in France, say. But it is in cities, Democrat cities in America, and it has been since the Civil War. And in fact, all the cities that were corrupt in the at the end of the Civil War, in the post-Civil War period, are all the ones that are corrupt and stole the election now. So, you know, whatever they find in Arizona. But, you know, let's look at it this way. Let's suppose you had real forensic work in the six states that that helped steal the election, that or the cities within those states that helped steal them. They're not going to remove Joe Biden from the White House and put Trump in. They just, you know, the Democrats are good at brazening it out. You know, I always like the Bertha thing, for example. The original Bertha was Obama because his press rep promoted Obama when he wrote his book as being born in Kenya. So on the publisher's website, in the bio of Barack Obama, it just said for years, this is the standard bio, born in Kenya, Barack Obama is blah, blah, blah. And don't tell me that Obama never saw that. Because I can tell you that one thing most writers pay attention to is the little bio that the publisher sends out, because they always put like stupid mistakes in there, or they describe you in ways you don't like. So you always want to be. So Obama's promoting himself as being born in Kenya. I don't know. It doesn't necessarily mean he was born in Kenya. He might at one point in his life just have thought it cooler to appear to be more exotic, and which would be a reasonable thing to do. And so so the whole Bertha thing gets going. And here's the thing, though. Do you reckon that even if someone had come up with a photograph of him emerging in the maternity ward of the coastal hospital at Mombasa, do you honestly think that the Supreme Court would have removed him? This is why what's going. This again is why, you know, permitted the recounts and all the rest of it are going on now because it's post facto. No one's going to take Biden out of the Oval Office, even if it turns out it was a Trump landslide. Jay Lawson writes, I find it surprising Joe Biden has not hired Hunter Biden as a special advisor on energy. Surely he's eminently qualified if he was worth $80,000 per month as an energy advisor overseas. Wonder why we're not tapping this brilliant mind. I think that's because Hunter, well, isn't he pursuing his art career? Didn't he have an exhibition? He's so talented. He's like an energy executive and he's a fantastic artist. He's got so many strings to his bow. But again, look. I don't rule that out. They're brazen, and they don't care about it. Charles Sharpless says, good afternoon, Mark, and thanks for all you do. Regarding your statement about the future of conservative media, are there any podcasts or podcasters, or perhaps more simply voices in alternative media, that you find particularly helpful or entertaining? And have you received an invitation to appear on any of them? Somewhat unrelated, Daniel Hannan, who I rather admire, recently posted a short video which was rather pessimistic. If you've seen it, I was curious about your thoughts. I haven't seen that, actually. Dan is a more moderate mean than I am. But I'm always interested in what he has to say. But I haven't seen that. I I don't know really whether I've received an invitation to appear on podcasts, because the person who books my media appearances would see all those. And you can tell, I mean, you know, really, when Rush died, I had the great privilege, and I did it a lot last year, of hosting what was the number one radio show and the number one cable TV show, Tucker and Rush. And the thing about it is, when you've done that, you don't particularly then want, you know, I mean, I'll do it if it's like a chum or if it's a show I happen to particularly like. But if you've been guest hosting the number one show, you don't particularly have any urge to go on the number 37 show or whatever. But I actually think, you know, Rush was basically single-handedly responsible for that entire model of talk radio. And what followed, and there are shows that are, and there are a lot of people actually that I enjoy listening to. I mean, I'm in northern New England. The big guy regionally is Howie Carr. He's on the New Hampshire and the Vermont and the Maine stations, and he's always the guy. You know, if he's appearing anywhere, it's a big deal. And I like Howie's show because he's got all these other features that aren't really to do with Mitch McConnell or whatever, like his police blotter Friday, where he's just reading out stories from the police blotter in local papers and things. He does all this organized crime thing and everything. And I like that sort of expanded world. People don't. People didn't like it when Rush did it. When Rush would start going on about football or about Apple products. But you know something? And people who listen to Rush and claim to be friends of Rush and say, I've listened for 30 years and all, ought to think about it, ought to think about what he gets being the big guy, and people hate him, people who've never listened to him loathe him, and they always talk about him in terms that was completely unlike anything Rush. Limbaugh was ranting. Limbaugh didn't spew and Limbaugh didn't rant. He was sitting there having the best time of his life. But there were people who hated him, and then when he announced his cancer, there were people saying, die, Rush. I hope it's hideous and painful and all the rest of it. And that's an enormous strain to bear for decades. And if a guy happens to like football and wants to talk about football as a way of mitigating the strain of being the focus of the absolutely insane hate from a generally know-nothing left. You know, this is where you shouldn't fall into the trap. The point of the left, the point about being in favor of small government is the government is small so that it frees up a lot of space for life. The minute you have big government, you have no life, which is this weird thing. When you listen to, when the left now, everything is political. So you can't even have you can't even read the gardening column without it going on about Trump or whatever. Radio or conservative media is going to change in the wake of Rush. There will never be another Rush. Everything is such small audiences now. Tucker's the number one show, and I love doing it, and I love holding his audience if Tucker's away. And it's like 3.5 million, which is basically 1% of the American population. And I remember, you know, I did shows in the UK that got like 12 million out of whatever it was then, 60 million in the UK. So a fifth of the population. So you'd walk out the street, down the street the following day, and people would go, oh, I thought you were a complete wanker on that thing last night. And I remember one time we worked on this documentary. I loved it, and I thought we'd done a really great show. And we were all devastated when the ratings came out. We only had an audience of 8 million. Oh, God, this is terrible. I'm finished. We have such a fragmented market now. All the people who hate Tucker and want to get him fired are people who don't watch Tucker. And all the people who never watch him, all they know is something they've heard, you know, that he's... It's a difficult world. It's fragmenting even more. And I don't know. There's never going to be another Rush. Alyssa Angel writes, add in some MMA fighting or conservative media is dunzo. All kidding aside, all media, conservative or otherwise, has to be entertaining, instructive or shocking to get a big enough audience to stay in business. Yes, possibly. I don't even actually know whether that's true now. I mean, there's nothing interesting or entertaining about most of these cable shows. A lot of them are very sad and bitter, you know. I don't quite know. And the form itself, can seem tired too. I don't know whether that applies anymore. At some point, when you're just fragmented, you know, you could do a podcast where you're just a bitter, hateful, twisted, misanthropic person, and it'd be quite when everything's niche, even unappealing niches are viable. Peter S. says, Mark, did you see Joe Biden acting like vintage Joe Biden? A bit unpredictable, local fake news words, and drove a new Ford 150 Lightning electric vehicle this week. Is the electric vehicle push something we should be suspicious of? I know Mr. Pelosi has invested in Tesla. Is it because the EU is moving towards EVs? Is China involved? There aren't going to be any cars soon. There'll be a vehicle, whatever it is, there'll be a vehicle which is, the technology is already there, basically. The government will know where you're going. So you might be going to Madame Fifi's bondage dungeon, or you might be going to some QAnon insurrectionist rally. But either way, the government will know where you are. And then when they introduce the self-driving cars, you'll be looking forward. You think, oh, gosh, I want to get to the big QAnon meeting so I can get a good seat near the front. And the car will be starting off for the QAnon rally. And then the government, somewhere in the deep state, they'll press a button and the self-driving car will drive you away from the QAnon rally and take you to Madame Fifi's bondage dungeon instead. We're moving... All these technologies, interestingly, are so old now. You know, like the motor vehicle. In the case of the motor vehicle and freedom, it's been a terrible year for freedom of movement, as we were talking about earlier. And I think actually the self-driving car with the GPS and all the other stuff, the self-driving car means that basically the government will be driving you to permitted destinations. And on that cheery note, we got a lot of other good questions. I'll try to get to them as always, to pick them up on the Mark Steyn Show and other things in the days ahead. But thank you for that. We went on a bit longer because we started a little bit longer because it started a little bit late because we rolled the pre-roll a bit late. But thank you for that. Do join. I mentioned Tal Backman. He's going to be here tomorrow at Steyn Online. We'll have Mark Steyn's Passing Parade. We'll have Rick McGuinness with Kathy Shadle is irreplaceable, but Kathy wanted us to give Rick McGuinness a shot at that slot, and Rick is proving very popular. He'll have another of his movie essays. We'll have a little bit of Tales for Our Time on Sunday, and of course some music in our Song of the Week. So a lot of busy stuff. But thank you for joining us, and thank you again for all your kind words on the fourth birthday of the Mark Steyn Club.
Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Steyn Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.